He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew.
These episodes focus on the brave men and women who fought in the war, not the politics that surrounded the war. And today we are interviewing Brigadier General Joe Ulatowski. And before we got started here, one of the things that Joe mentioned to me was that what he is going to be reflecting to us in his comments. And Joe was there four different times during the entire war, are unique to him. And he made it such a very good point that you have 100 men in the field in a combat situation, you have 100 stories that come back. So Joe wants to let this audience know that these are his experiences and from his perspective. And we've asked him to come and share those with us. So, Joe, we're going to try and break this down a little bit in the fact that let's talk about the four times that you were there. The first time was when there were just advisors, and that was when, about 64.
And as you get there at 65, when the war started heating up.
Right. And then you were there again during Tet, and that was in...
Well, then I was there in 1967.
Uh-huh.
And it covered the Tet of that year.
Uh-huh.
And again in 70... Or in 1964, I was there as a battalion commander in the 1st Infantry Division.
Okay.
And in 70, as a brigade commander in the 25th Infantry Division. And then in 74 or so, I was there as the commander of the Joint Casualty Resolution Center.
Okay.
Where we looked for those who didn't make it back from the war.
Okay. And interesting because in 70, that was the time when we were kind of building down, wasn't that?
Yes, it was.
Because I graduated just that year from college, and I went over and did my draft physical in Seattle at that time. And that's when they had the big lottery and, you got a number on your birthday and everything. And I had a fairly medium number, but because they were not building up, I was not drafted at that time. And I was teaching. They wanted me as a special ed teacher. So let's talk a little bit about that first time that you were there, and what was the environment and the type, the people that were there, and how were they advising? They were advising the North, or not the North Vietnamese Army. They were advising the South Vietnamese Army.
Yes, every South Vietnamese Army unit had an American advisor. And the level of activity at the time was broken down into four zones, four corps. And let's take the corps I was with, in the Central Highlands. And it was commanded by a lieutenant general in the Vietnamese Army. And he had a full colonel as his advisor. And the colonel then beneath him had Americans that were counterparts for the staff and even some of the units in the field. So that was the general structure at the time. And every advisor was different based on their personality. You had those who viewed themselves as pure advisors and stood by and waited for someone to give them some sort of guidance or requests for help. Others who almost viewed themselves as commanders who would tell the South Vietnamese what they should do. And the others were pretty damn good. So it all depended on the personality of the advisor.
Sure, probably the same way with the military in this country, too. Some were more active than others.
Well, you're dealing with a cross-section of the American population.
Right.
And you've got all sorts of different kinds of people. The military environment was at a very low level at that point. There were raids by the Viet Cong. Everything was attributed to the Viet Cong, not to the North Vietnamese. This was then in my corps, and you have to realize that every corps there had a different combat environment. So for that year, I saw the combat environment in the area the size of the state of Florida, the two corps. There were roaming bands of what we viewed as Viet Cong. There were the Viet Cong guerrillas. And so everyone was trying to address a double level. There was not initially in 64 any high-level combat. It was all search, 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 try and root out where these people had their bases and that sort of thing. As the year went on and as the level of activity started to build up, and toward the end of the year and early 65, it started to hit a higher crescendo. The South Vietnamese were being fought out there, and there were ambushes out there, ammunition convoys coming over the mountain, supply convoys were ambushed. The 16 or so special forces camp that we had in two corps were being attacked. One was wiped out. There was even a report from the South Vietnamese, and I saw this myself. I was a G3 or plans and training advisor to the Corps G3, that they said there was obvious North Vietnamese. But this is where you run into problems with the intelligence.
Sure.
There. You cannot, according to whatever standards each command sets up, is whether how you report them and how it's reflected on the overall situation. MACV, the senior headquarters, needed multiple reports before they could report North Vietnamese were in South Vietnam.
You mentioned kind of bands of people going out and of the Viet Cong and the Viet Cong guerrillas kind of going out and attacking different bases and things. Were they coordinated? Were they very?
They were very. It was assumed there were small bands. Then you had this escalation. No, the small bands weren't doing the attacking. It was the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an increasing crescendo when the Americans came in. And, you know, you had the Gulf of whatever it was. I don't remember anymore.
Gulf of Tonkin? No.
Gulf of Tonkin there. And that, and the decision was made to start bringing the Americans in. And I left about that time.
Okay.
Some Vietnamese took the advice that we gave them. I was very fortunate to work with one. And we worked very closely together. I thought our relationship was good. And of course, you cannot go talk about any of this without mentioning the politics that were going on in Saigon. So while I was there, you switched a number of presidents. You had Big Men, you had the Key, the Air Force guy. All of these, you had this undercurrent going there all the time. You couldn't get, it affected everything that the Vietnamese Army did.
It seemed like almost for a while, just when I go back and look at the news at that time and look at things, that the leadership in South Vietnam was almost, it seemed like it was almost musical chairs, you know.
Yes.
It moved around very quickly, and there was an advantage to be in charge of everything, and especially I'm assuming when the Americans started coming in more numbers, that brings all kinds of supplies and the ability to probably do, you know, if you want to do more black market stuff and everything like that. Is that does that make any sense? Maybe not.
Well, you're always going to find that going on,
right?
And I think it has, in some respects, been overplayed.
Uh-huh.
In other respects, underplayed. Again, it's a situational sort of thing. Who is taking care of it? Who is your honest commander? And all of that. I personally did not see any corruption.
Sure.
But it doesn't mean it wasn't there. And you also have to, when dealing with these people, not only in Vietnam or anywhere in the world, you're going to have the same thing.
Sure. The same thing in every year in Iraq and Iran.
Iran.
You name the place and you've got the same situation.
And you're getting people saying the same thing today about Ukraine. There are people who are going to do it. There is no question.
Right.
All you can do is try and stop it.
And again, I really try and be positive because I'm, you know, when I think of situations like that, probably 99% of the people were very ethical and good and fought for a reason. And yet you're always going to have somebody that's going to take advantage of a situation.
Yes, very definitely. You know,
and I've always tried to stay on the 99% side of that. You know, I'm
good.
I'm not a very good liar. You know, I think I maybe lied to my wife a couple times, and both times I got caught. And I learned very quickly that was not the approach to take. And, you know, so when you start to lie, you eventually get in deeper. Somebody told me that if you never lie, you never have to remember what you said. And I think that that's true. So, you know, was there a lot of material coming in, even at that time, from China and munitions and things like that to support, do we know?
Well, yes, obviously.
Yeah.
They were funneling it down. The Ho Chi Minh Trail started to get active, And in fact, we used to go up at the time and fly over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, even though it wasn't authorized.
Uh-huh.
And yes, both sides were funneling lots of aid in. It was the build-up time.
Right.
And so then I left.
Yeah, and then so were you when you were flying above the Ho Chi Minh Trail, were you actually seeing people and, you know?
No, they were very good at hiding themselves in most cases.
Uh-huh.
And there were other people who were monitoring the trail, mainly special forces. And they could call in airstrikes when they saw groups.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw the only thing we saw was the evidence of heavy activity on the trail, but not the activity itself.
So, yeah, so you saw the ruts in the road, but not the people making the ruts. Yeah, yeah. And so then you said after that, then you left and you came back to the United States?
Yes.
Okay. And what was the atmosphere like at that time? Was it, you know, you were, you know, obviously in the military and fairly high up, and was the atmosphere that we're going to need to build this up, or it's we're going to need to go back and bring more people in, or was, and that's a political decision too. And was that Kennedy? Was it Kennedy? Was at that time? Was is that?
Who I think it was Nixon.
Okay, that's
and,
right.
And well.
And I'm not really trying to get political, but I, you know, just like you say, you can't separate the two.
No, you can't. And because the politicians influence everything. It's how much money they appropriate, what they think, and how they react to what their constituents say and all of that sort of stuff. And I don't know about the politics, but I know the attitude of the population and the attitude of the press that time was already becoming anti-military. They were looking for problems. Mm-hmm. I know in several of the actions that I was had firsthand was involved in there with my counterpart, they were already saying they were the South Vietnamese were using, with our assistance, were using this tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
And the press at that time, the reporters that were out there with us, were saying, well, isn't this anti Geneva Convention or whatever.
Thinking of like mustard gas in World War I
and those types of things. And the South Vietnamese were using it to get them out of their holes.
Sure.
And, you know, it's and it was sort of like a political viewpoint there.
Yeah. And I you know, I don't know how many folks that we've interviewed that have said, kind of made a comment similar to the fact that if, you know, people have said, was the war in Vietnam winnable? And most of the military people I've interviewed said, if it had been run by the military, it probably would have been winnable, but it was run by politicians. And like the issues of not being able to go into Cambodia, or people that I interviewed that said, well, we knew where we were, but we couldn't say where we were. You know, we were over the border and in an area that we shouldn't have been in. But that was, you know, our commanding officers were saying, you go there, and, you know, and that's what happens. So it was already starting to be kind of a negative environment in the United States.
It was beginning to be. I mean, my kids, I went back on leave to My wife's home in Nebraska, and my kids stayed there at the time. And they said they were told their father was a murderer.
Really?
Yeah. So, yeah, there it was starting.
And again, even then, I think it depended where you were. Now,
yes.
I grew up in Allensburg. The people in the community tended to be very supportive of it.
Yeah.
The people at the college level and the young people at the college level were the exact opposite. I remember, you know, marches in Allensburg and things like that. And,
sure.
But I also had lots of friends that came back. They graduated in 66 and were in Vietnam 3 months later. And, came back. And when they came back, they were treated well by their family and population and everything.
Well, you know, you have to kind of understand what the way the politicians in the world were looking at things then. There was still the monolithic Soviet Union and Chinese rapprochement where they were, I guess that's the right word, where there was this fear that if we didn't help the South Vietnamese develop a government there that would be favorable to us, it would be another chip of the domino.
And that's so interesting you mentioned that, Joe, because, you know, that's back when, you know, I went to the movies at the Liberty Theater in Ellensburg. And with every movie you went to, there was a cartoon, usually who was a mouse, so was somebody in Jerry, Tom and Jerry. And then they had a newsreel that, you know, would have what's going on in the world and everything.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember this kind of caricature of all these countries in Southeast Asia. And they had set it up like dominoes.
Mm-hmm.
And as one domino fell and knocked over that other one. And that's what I think was the fear at that time, was that, like you said, if one of them falls, and if, you know, kind of the old philosophy, you know, give them an inch and they'll take a mile, that was probably the big fear.
Well, and you'll always have to look at, when you look at these things, you can look at this is today, this is what I'm doing and all of that. But you also have to take a look from the big picture. What happens if? And what are we going to try and do about it?
And
it was true back then. It was true in Korea. It was true in Vietnam.
And, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that Joe mentioned was that in the military you have all different levels, and people are advising other people. And we got into talking about whether or not they, in Israel, that this attack by Hamas, whether they, security and, knew about it. Well, his feeling was they probably, with all the types of observation that they have, probably somebody had a pretty good idea that this was going to happen, but was that the person's advice that they took?
This is where you start getting into the political thing.
Yeah.
I know in between there, I served, one of my jobs ended up being, one of the war planners. And there is an entire chain of planning that goes on as any event takes place in the world, where people start looking and saying, this is happening. What if the president says we need to respond? What can we bring to bear, and how can we bring it to bear?
And how quickly?
Well, yeah. And of course, that's the main thing. And this goes on almost daily as events happen around the world. There's always somebody looking at it and reporting up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who then gets this reported to the president. Mr. President, if you want to take this activity. So there's your political decision.
Sure.
And yeah. The people down the chain go to work.
Well, I think this gets us pretty well along here, and with this buildup and how America was looking at it. One of the things that I also noticed was that at least with Vietnam, even at that time, news was coming back pretty quickly. In other words, you know, in World War II, we didn't hear about even battles until quite a bit later. Whereas in 65 and 66, I saw in Walter Cronkite, they had the list of, 110 troops killed in Vietnam today, so it was much more immediate. I think the effect was...
When, of course, it was on TV.
Yes.
Where people saw things happening.
Yeah.
That before they just were statistics.
Yeah.
And that certainly had an impact.
Yeah. Well, let's stop right there. And we will continue this conversation with Brigadier General Joe Ulatowski in just another series, episode.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.